Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Good to have you with us. On today's program, we explore the differences residents in the UP and Northwest Lower Peninsula have as compared with the trolls, you know, folks who live under the Mackinac Bridge, how perspectives about our state change depending on where we live. And then, later in the hour, the story behind Banner Gibson guitars in Kalamazoo and the World War II-era women who crafted them. But first, just what the image of Detroit did not need. As you've likely heard by now, a state election panel will decide the official outcome of Detroit's mayoral primary. That's because Wayne County's election board refused to certify the election. It should be noted, the county election board acted on the very last day before the deadline to certify the election. The controversy centers on some 20,000 write-in votes that may have been incorrectly marked by Detroit poll workers. Former Detroit Medical Center CEO Mike Duggan appeared to win the primary handily over Wayne County Sheriff Benny Napoleon. Despite running as a write-in candidate, Duggan won by about 16 points, according to those unofficial results. But if these almost 20,000 write-in votes would be tossed out, the two winners would switch places, with Napoleon coming out on top and Duggan finishing second. Whatever the outcome, Duggan and Napoleon will square off in November. But this drama raises concerns, including the ability of Detroit poll workers to do their jobs properly, and whether there needs to be a recount, and whether, as suggested by Benny Napoleon, the U.S. Department of Justice needs to babysit the big November election in Detroit. Joining us to help sort this all out is Jocelyn Benson, interim dean of Wayne State University's law school. She's an expert in Michigan's constitutional and election law. Jocelyn, welcome back to Stateside.
Good to be here, Cynthia.
Well, break it down for us who have been following this swirl of stories since this all broke late yesterday. Hash marks, numbers, what happened?
Well, essentially, the County Board of Canvassers reviewed all of the write-in votes and tallies for the write-in candidates in the mayoral election and found a policy under state law that are under a state regulation in a manual for counting write-in votes from the Secretary of State's office that says when you count write-in votes, you should tally them with hash marks. And so they said, well, this didn't happen, therefore, what do we do now? And there was some talk about disqualifying the ballots, which is really out of left field. There's nothing in the law that would enable the disqualification of the ballots. And then ultimately, the County Board of Canvassers did the right thing and said, well, it's not clear what to do. Let's ask the state for guidance.
So this has nothing to do with the people who showed up to cast their votes. This had to do with who was counting them.
Yes. What this is an issue of is between balancing the integrity of the ballot and the need to protect every eligible voter's vote. And again, there's nothing to suggest that an eligible voter who cast a valid ballot won't have that ballot counted. And it has everything to do to suggest that there's some just a lack of clarity under the state rules as to how write-in votes should be tallied. Because we're really in this uncharted territory with tens of thousands of write-in votes. And, you know, it's important for the state to get it right for future elections as well. So that's the issue here. And that's what the State Board of Canvassers will be looking at.
Now, do you think this kind of thing might happen all the time in elections, but only because of the big issue with Mike Duggan having to run as a write-in candidate, that there was so much more attention paid and there were so many more write-in ballots?
Certainly. I mean, we are in a bit of uncharted territory because write-in campaigns themselves are very rare. And on top of that, write-in campaigns that received as many votes as this candidate did in the primary election are also very rare. And so that has added some more spotlight to what is simply a question of interpretation of a state regulation. But again, there was some gasoline thrown on the fire when it was suggested that these ballots for some reason should be disqualified. And again, there's nothing in the law that would allow for that. And so the real question is just how should write-in votes be tallied to make sure the count is accurate.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jocelyn Benson, who is an expert in Michigan's constitutional and election law. She's also interim dean of Wayne State University's law school. As we look at just what's at issue with the problems with some 20,000 write-in ballots in the Detroit mayoral primary. Well, before we talk about today's developments, let's talk about, speaking of the gasoline being thrown on the fire, there was all kinds of blame being tossed around. People were pointing fingers at Detroit City Clerk Janice Winfrey, at her election inspectors for not doing the hashtags at the county board, for waiting till the 14th day after the election to start thinking of potential ballot issues. Where, in, as you digest all of this, where do you believe the blame should go, or is it a matter of blame?
Well, make no doubt about it. We need to do a better job of training our poll workers throughout the state. I think there needs to be things like tests for poll workers to make sure they know the rules before being appointed and beginning the election day. And we need to make sure everyone in charge of elections on the local level, in the poll worker or election inspector, as they're called, capacity, know all of the requirements for them on a particular day. And it seems to be that not only did was there some confusion about how to tally these ballots, but that confusion led to poll workers in Detroit not using the hash marks that the state regulation book indicated should be used. But in the defense of those poll workers in the city of Detroit, it really isn't clear under the current manuals from the state that hashtags, one, absolutely must be used, and two, of course, it's not clear at all. In fact, there's nothing to indicate that if hashtags are not used to tally write-in ballots, that therefore the ballots themselves are somehow invalid.
Does this say to you that perhaps the entire election system in Michigan is too complicated and too convoluted?
Well, I would say that in many ways, elections everywhere have become increasingly complicated in really the years since the Bush v. Gore decision in the 2000 election, where we saw an increase in litigation being used to determine election disputes. And we're certainly at a point now where state legislators across the country are enacting more and more laws and requirements for poll workers and other officials that are creating a lot of opportunities for confusion on election day. So there does need to be an effort to streamline the process, because if we just look at the poll workers themselves, yes, we can say we need to provide better training, and the state needs to do that and has a responsibility to do that. But we also have to recognize that these are individuals who are making a very small amount of money, working extensive hours throughout the day, and have a significant responsibility. So we need to do more to help them do their job, and that may involve many reforms to the process.
Based on everything you've heard, Jocelyn Benson, is there any whiffs to you of shenanigans or skullduggery?
From the facts as we know them and that are public, it does not appear that there's anything beyond just a question of how the ballots were tallied. And the reason why the hashtag controversy is such a big deal for those who are proponents of saying these ballots need to be recorded through hashtags is that we want to make sure that only eligible ballots are being counted and that the ballots have been secured and the integrity of the ballots are protected. And so when you, for example, hypothetically see just one number, 62 write-in votes for this particular candidate, you need to have some verification mechanism, and that's what those hashtags are designed to do, to say 1, 2, 3, 4, this is how we reached 62. So without those, it does perhaps raise some red flags, but I think what's happened here is, as those red flags have been raised, again, we've seen gasoline thrown on the fire, and that has exacerbated things out of control. And the bottom line for everyone right now is that there's been nothing to indicate that the top two candidates for the mayoral primary have not changed, and therefore none of this appears to have any impact on which two candidates will be on the ballot this fall.
And meantime, today we hear from State Elections Director Chris Thomas, and we also had Detroit City Clerk Janice Winfrey both speaking out and speaking their minds and explaining. So what have we heard first from Janice Winfrey?
Well, we've received notification information from City Clerk Janice Winfrey that basically criticizing the county for, number one, waiting until the last day in the deadline period to announce the certification to raise this issue, saying that if it had been raised earlier, then they could have hand-counted whatever ballots were in question and addressed the concerns. But like everyone needs to do, she's also criticizing any attempts to disqualify any vote, because again, as long as it's an eligible voter in which their intent is clear on a writing candidate, that ballot should count. So she's also emphasized her focus on training poll workers to do their job, and says in her view that a lot of the worksheets, the hashtags, don't matter because the hashtags or the tally marks aren't required under law. But there is a state manual that does demonstrate the recording of write-in votes through using these tally marks. It just, again, the question is what happens when you don't, and that's what the State Board of Canvassers will look at.
And then from Lansing, we heard from State Elections Director Chris Thomas, because now the ball is in Lansing's court, isn't it?
Yes, and it's truly the job of the Secretary of State to be out in front of this issue and clearly defining what is and is not proper under the law. In the absence of that, we've seen the State Elections Director come forward and reassure voters that that there's no authority to disqualify the ballots, and noting that the tabulation method needs to be looked at because the markings that are used to count the write-in ballots need to be looked at and counted. But he clearly said, whether it's a hash mark or a number that was used to mark in the counting of the ballots, that is not sufficient grounds to disqualify a vote.
Do we think we'll see a recount?
There's nothing right now to indicate that a recount is necessary or to recount or retabulate all of the votes that have been cast. All we need to do is ensure that the ballots in question were properly counted and secured, and that is likely where the focus will be. And again, just to emphasize, we're talking only about the votes for the write-in candidate at issue here, so other candidates' votes have remained relatively unchanged.
And Chris Thomas also gave a vote of confidence to Janice Winfrey, didn't he?
Yes, and recognizing that, number one, we are in uncharted territory here, but the errors that she and her team are being criticized of are not errors that are clearly errors under the law, and number two, are not errors that would give rise, it would seem, to the disqualification of valid votes.
Jocelyn Benson is an expert in Michigan's constitutional and election law and is also the interim dean at the Wayne State University Law School. Jocelyn, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And speaking of Detroit, later in the program, we get a look at the differing views of that city as it faces its financial crisis. In 20 minutes, the view from northern Michigan. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. That is the sound of a Gibson guitar. Not any Gibson guitar. It's a Banner Gibson, built during World War II and considered among the finest acoustic guitars ever made. Over 9,000 of these Banners were carefully built during the war. The thing is, Gibson Company records show the company had shifted to producing goods for the war effort and not instruments. And most of the men who made those Gibsons at the headquarters in Kalamazoo were off fighting the war. So, just who made these guitars that are still prized 70 years later? That question and his love of guitars drove a Connecticut law professor to discover the remarkable answer, and he's turned it into a book called Kalamazoo Gals, a story of extraordinary women and Gibson's Banner guitars of World War II. Dr. John Thomas joins us from his office on the campus of Quinnipiac University School of Law. Welcome, John. And we're also joined by one of the Kalamazoo Gals profiled in John's book. Irene Stearns worked at the Gibson Guitar headquarters in Kalamazoo during the war, and Irene joins us from her kitchen in Kalamazoo. Hello, Irene.
Hi.
We're glad to have
you. Here I am in the kitchen.
There you go. We're very glad you're with us. John, I want to start with you. Tell us what actually launched you on this quest. You found a photograph.
I did. I was in the middle of a freelance writing project. I alluded to it in the introduction. I do teach law, but my passion is for music and guitar music in particular, and I've done some freelance writing for a number of music magazines over the years. And at one point, I came across a photograph. I can't recall how I came across it. It was a picture of a large group, maybe 70 women, standing out in front of the Gibson Guitar Factory in Kalamazoo, Michigan, in the mid-1940s. I later learned that it was particularly a 1944 photograph. And to say that picture haunted me probably is not much of an overstatement. I pinned it to the bulletin board in my office, and just kept finding my attention, going back to it, wondering, what were all these women doing in front of that factory during World War II?
So how did you go about the digging? Because, as you say, the records that the company kept showed there was no instrument production during the war.
That's right. So that was one of the first things I needed to do, was to find out whether there was instrument production. Gibson had denied building guitars during the war. The fellow who was the personnel director who hired all those women, personnel director during the war, hired those women in that photograph, named Julius Belson, published a company history in 1973 in which he stated they built no guitars. during the war. And so the first thing I needed to do was to see whether that was true. And it took me a long time working back channels. I finally got into the Gibson corporate headquarters, which is in Nashville. I spent 3 days there, photographed 4,400 pages of shipping ledgers, and then counted those guitars up, and they shipped about 24,000 instruments. So now I've got this incredible mystery, which is why would Gibson deny making these instruments?
Yes.
And particularly because the men were gone who made them. And I kept thinking about that photograph. I just kept coming back to that photograph. And so eventually I decided I needed to try to find one of those, what I came to call Kalamazoo gals in Kalamazoo. And so I took out advertisements in the Kalamazoo Gazette and surrounding area newspapers, not asking for women, just asking if you worked during the war for Gibson, I'm coming to town, I'd like to meet you.
Huh.
And lo and behold, I found 12 of these women.
And that's how you realized who was in the photo.
That's right. I found these 12 women in that photograph, went to Kalamazoo now 3 times to interview them and record my interviews, and fell in love with the story, but also fell in love with these gals like Irene Stearns here, who's on the phone. Just changed my life in all kinds of extraordinary ways, but also let me write a book.
Irene, tell us, how did you come to work at the Gibson Guitar headquarters during the war?
Well, I put my name in every place I could think of because jobs were hard to find when I got out of school. So it took me about 6 months to find a job, but we just went every day on the bus, went to every place we could think of, so I had my name in there. And one day they called, and a neighbor came running over because we didn't have a phone, and said, well, you better go down to Gibson. They have a job for you. So I went down, got my job.
And what did you do? What was that job?
At first, I made single strings. And then part of the time I did the coiling. And then sometimes I would have to go down to the stock room and get more wire or tape or something, whatever they needed.
Now, what did you know, Irene Stearns, about making guitars when they hired you?
Oh, nothing. I never played one. I listened to them. Loved to listen, but I didn't know a thing about it.
And John Thomas, isn't that what you found makes it so extraordinary, that these women, these Kalamazoo gals, had no training making musical instruments, yet they turned out exquisite guitars?
Yeah, that's right. One of the really intriguing things to me was how great these guitars are. And I asked the women who did work on guitars. Now, Irene built strings, and most of the women I found did something other than build guitars. About a quarter of them worked on the guitars, which was probably typical cross-section of the workforce at that time. And I asked the women all women there that I met, but also particularly the women who built guitars, what was your training? And they looked at me like, yeah, it's out of my mind. What do you mean by training? Well, who showed you how to do the task? Well, nobody. Well, how did you learn it? Well, they sat down and I watched the person next to me. Then I asked a couple of questions which were both really fortuitous but also revealed just how naive I was about the time and gender roles and that sort of thing. I was trying to figure out, how did these women have these skills to build guitars? So I asked women, well, did you have hobbies? Now, I recommend never ask a woman who grew up in the Depression, supported a family or herself through World War II, whether she had a hobby. They had no hobbies. Excuse me, sir. Excuse me, Sonny. What did you mean by hobby? And so I sort of retracted and said, well, what did you do in your free time? Another bad question, right? No,
what
free time.
Time?
This is not a time. But I finally came across the right question, which was, well, did you do sewing, needlepoint, crocheting, that sort of thing? And they all said yes. So my contention is, and it's proven out in the guitars, and I can talk about my scientific research about that.
Yeah.
But in January 1942, when these women in Kalamazoo walk into the factory, at precisely the moment Glenn Miller's I've Got a Gal in Kalamazoo peaks on the pop charts, by the way, Gibson got the most skilled workforce in its history. And it's proven out in the guitars.
You did some scientific exploration to compare these guitars.
Well, I did. As you pointed out, I work at Quinnipiac University, and we have a great imaging department that's part of our medical school here. And I was sitting in my office again one day wondering how I could measure differences between the guitars made by men and women. And the reason I could distinguish them is because during the war, and only during the war, starting in 42 and coming off in 1945, there's a little golden banner decal on the headstocks of the guitars, which is where the tuner's attached. It says, only a Gibson is good enough. That little decal appears in January 1942, disappears in late 1945. So if I find a guitar with that little banner on, as I call it, I know it's built by women, primarily women. There were some men working there as well, doing the roughing
mm-hmm.
parts. So I called up the imaging department and said, you know, I'd really like to do a project, and I'm thinking they're going to laugh at me and say, forget it. I'd like to X-ray guitars, and I explained the background. They said, wow, that sounds great. Come on over. So I lined up collectors from up and down the East Coast to bring in guitars just before the war, just after the war, and then a batch during the war.
Okay.
And we X-rayed them. And we have state-of-the-art equipment, so I could measure everything to the 10,000th of a whatever, millimeter, inch, degree, what have you. And the women's guitars, women-built guitars, were more refined. It's every little plate, every little brace, every little piece of material in a guitar is sanded just a tiny bit thinner, just a tiny bit smoother, and that's the difference. And I contend, and people can hear this, that's why they sound so great.
They still sound great 70 years later. In fact, on your website, on KalamazooGals.com, you offer a CD, and you have a collection of these Banner Gibsons being played with a song for each of the Kalamazoo Gals. And what's Irene's song?
Well, Irene's song, because Irene still shimmies, is I wish I could shimmy like my sister Kate. And Irene, last time we met, which was back in March, we danced in your living room to what song? We danced,
yeah,
I've got a gal in Kalamazoo. I walked in, Irene's family put the vinyl on the record player, the turntable, and we danced a little bit, didn't we, Irene?
Oh, did we ever. And I didn't even know how, but you know how when John's leading.
Irene, when John contacted you and said, I want to find out more about what you did, had it been a long time since anyone ever cared about what you did during the war at the Gibson factory in Kalamazoo?
Oh, my goodness. Nobody ever cared about it. I didn't. It was just a crummy job at the time, any job, you know. And so I could make my 20 or 25 cents an hour. And you'd go any place to do that. And I didn't think it would ever be thought about again. Who would ever think that?
And when you think, Irene, that the guitars you helped build, that here we are in 2013 and you have folks who are guitar experts saying they're among the finest ever made, you wouldn't have thought that at the time, would you?
Oh, my goodness, no. And I didn't really work on the guitars. I just made the strings. But John said, well, can't play the guitar without the strings. So I guess that was important, too.
That's right. Without those strings, the guitars make no music.
Not at all. John, I am wondering, as you say, the mystery is the fact that Gibson just didn't, they rather pretended this didn't happen, even though they were selling thousands of guitars that were being made by the women. Do you think it was because there was maybe a sense in the 40s that companies shouldn't be diverting workers to non-essential production?
I think that's probably part of it. Gibson was probably the most patriotic company in the country if you measure it by productivity toward the war. Gibson was the only company to win 3 E for Excellence awards from the armed services. And so I think Gibson was in part reluctant to concede that. But at the time, all the advertisements of the day that Gibson put out, and I searched through all the old magazines, Downbeat magazine and trade magazines, Gibson reported that it was building no guitars until the boys came home. Now, I didn't say we're not building guitars during the war. We're building no guitars until the boys come home from war. In addition, I have a transcript from a meeting with what was known as the War Production Board, which was the regulatory agency that controlled and rationed all kinds of items over the wartime.
Sure, sure.
The Gibson CEO at the time, a fellow named Guy Hart, heard, you know, recorded in writing, in transcript, complaining that the company was being run totally by women. So I believe, and the evidence I think is pretty clear, that the primary reason Gibson denied making the guitars was Gibson was really unsure about whether the consuming public would buy guitars made by women.
Mm.
So as a result, they sold all these guitars, and they shipped them to dealers, and obviously the guitars went out and were sold. They shipped them as though they were, we would call today, new old stock. They built them before the war, and they've been stockpiled. So they were shipping out guitars, saying, we won't build any guitars till the boys come home. The guitars are made by women.
Interesting. Now, has Gibson, I know they relocated from Kalamazoo to Nashville some years ago. Since your research has proven beyond the shadow of a doubt that you had this group of women making these marvelous Banner guitars, have they embraced that history and acknowledged this?
They've embraced the history. They've acknowledged it. I have embarked on a joint project with Gibson. I volunteered my time for Gibson to issue replicas of these World War II guitars to be built by the women in the factory. One of the women in the factory, still in the Gibson acoustic guitar factory, named Valerie Belitho, a fantastic builder. She is the head of the acoustic custom shop. So she has built guitars for people like Johnny Depp and any really fancy, intricate work. She does that. And she was the head of the project. Gibson started that project. As far as I know now, Gibson has backed off of the project because of apparently they're worried about just, you know, economic issues of any kind of company. I'm hoping they'll re-embrace it, but at one point in time they had committed to doing it, and I'm worried that history might repeat itself because they pulled back from that.
John, I know you've come to Kalamazoo from Connecticut. You have had teas and you've met with the Kalamazoo gals. By the way, did you dub them the Kalamazoo gals because of the Glenn Miller song?
Exactly. You know, once I discovered when they walked into the factory, and at that very moment, and for the next 8 weeks, Glenn Miller's I've Got a Gal in Kalamazoo was number one on the pop charts. Yeah, I dubbed them the Kalamazoo gals. It was really no choice. It was almost fate.
How has meeting these women and uncovering their story, how has that changed you?
It's changed me in a lot of ways. One is sort of professionally. That is that I feel like I was lucky to discover an unknown piece of American history. So I could tell a story that no one even knew about. You know, we all knew about Rosie the Riveter. No one knew about Laura the Luthier. So that's part of it. But much more deeply, I discovered these beautiful people who gave me a window into a past that really is part of my own past. These, the Kalamazoo gals, are the same age as my parents were, who are no longer with me. Irene is now my surrogate mother, right, Irene?
Oh, right. And you can't get out of that.
No. And so, you know, it was a window into some of my own past, and I contend, you know, I never really asked my parents about this. And my theory is, because in my teen years, I figured if my parents had experienced it, it couldn't be very interesting, right? How cool could that be?
Absolutely.
So in part, it was self-discovery of my own history, of the history of the country, and this window into a time. Studs Terkel is one of my heroes and had agreed to read my manuscript, and he died just before I got it to him.
Mm.
He was really one of the originators of the oral history tradition, and he wrote a book during World War II which he called The Good War. And during my time, our wars, we could probably debate whether they were good or bad, but there wasn't this clear moral imperative, whereas World War II, there's a clear moral imperative. So I get a window into this time when people willingly sacrificed, right? Nobody complained about rationing. Everybody volunteered for the war. I only could find a single lawsuit, even though the government took over the entire economy, shut down Singer sewing machines, shut down Steinway piano because those were wasteful efforts, but everybody just got on board. So it was also a window into history, a window into a time when the country was united, and just incredible gift to me to enrich my own knowledge of my country, of our past, and my own past.
And Irene Stearns, what about for you to have someone come into your life 70 years later to celebrate, as you said, that crummy job that paid 25 cents an hour, and now you have your new surrogate son. How has that changed your life?
Oh, I just can't even explain it. But I have a little book here that I picked up the other day. It's about everyday love, and it's all little things on each page is different. And the author is unknown, but I think John must have written this. It said, some people come into our lives, leave footprints on our hearts, and we are never the same. Well, that's John. He came to Kalamazoo, and he did this for me. And not only me, but my whole family, Kathy, our friend that was here when he was in our house, and almost everybody that tells me about reading the book. So see what you did, John?
That is so sweet. And you can see now, Cindy, why every time I go back to Kalamazoo, I spend all my time both with a smile on my face and tears in my eyes. It's just overwhelms me and touches me. The way folks have responded to my story, well, their story that I uncovered and told, it's just a beautiful thing. I'm going to go back in September. I just can't get enough of my Kalamazoo gals.
You can learn more about John's book and about a special CD that was done using a collection of these Banner Gibsons. Just go to his website, KalamazooGals.com. John Thomas, Irene Stearns, thanks to both of you for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having us, and especially for giving me another chance to chat with Irene.
Oh, thank you.
Still to come, in a grassroots campaign, the Upper Peninsula has recently voted to create a poet laureate. We'll speak to him in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In the 5 weeks since Detroit filed for bankruptcy, there's been so much conversation, much reporting, much editorializing. What does it mean? Who'll be affected? How can Detroit turn itself around? Lots of opinions, lots of views. One view we have not gotten yet on Stateside is the view of the Detroit bankruptcy from up north. And that's something we'll remedy right now as we welcome Ken Winter, former editor and publisher of the Petoskey News Review, and we might add a member of the Michigan Journalism Hall of Fame, and joining us from up north, where he got an up-close take on the UP's view of Detroit, is Michigan Radio's political analyst, Jack Lessenberry. Let's start with the Upper Peninsula. Jack, you spoke with people in Marquette, which, as you note, would be the capital of the UP if it were a separate state. Do folks there resent all the attention paid to Detroit's troubles?
I don't think they resent it. I just think they think it's sort of another world. Marquette is as far away from Detroit as Springfield, Illinois is. And it's sort of they feel sorry about it. They see it sort of mysterious. It's not uncommon to meet people who shudder at the thought of going south of the bridge. I talked to one young woman who actually was finishing a master's degree who said she once went almost down as far as Flint, but it was too crowded and too many people for her. So, but they do feel. I talked to a longtime sort of political fixture there, a man named Tom Baldini, and he said that while they feel sorry for Detroit, they think that Detroit ought to pull itself up by its own bootstraps.
And Ken, how about the Northwest Lower Peninsula? How is the bankruptcy playing in Petoskey?
I think pretty much the same way Jack describes it. You know, there's a lot of back and forth between Detroit and Northwest Michigan with people having second homes, but the local people here really don't pay a lot of attention to Detroit other than to go down occasionally to a ball game or a concert or maybe catch the DIA. They're pretty much the same way. They feel like they've had to pick up themselves by the bootstraps and take care of their own needs up here on their own with no help from anybody else, and sort of feel that same way that Detroit should be doing it and wish they had declared bankruptcy 20 years ago.
Now, what you had just mentioned about folks maybe going down and going to a game or going to the DIA, does the DIA, the potential threat to its collection, does that hit home for folks in Northwest Michigan?
Only in very small circles. I serve on the Art Center board, and of course that group is very concerned about it, as are other wealthier people, the local people that like to go to the Tigers or go to Greenfield Village or the zoo. They don't really pay much attention to it. But the people that have a bigger focus on art, it's just unconscionable to think that they would break up that collection.
There's two kind of communities. I mean, there's two communities in places like Charlevoix and Petoskey. There are the people who live there, live their whole lives there. I talked to a young woman last year who had never been anywhere in her life other than Charlevoix and Petoskey. But then there are not only the summer people, but those of us who come up here when we can. And even some people, I talked to people in Sutton's Bay who came down three or four times a year. They went to the DIA. They went to Eastern Market and loaded up on things. So they like the thought that those cultural jewels are there. And I think it would be very sad if something happened to them.
But there's not a sense of investment, personal investment in what does or doesn't happen with Detroit. That's what I think I hear.
I think only in the sense that some, you know, think that it's not right that a major city in our state would go bankrupt. But at the same token, they don't feel they're the ones that should bail it out.
I think that's true. I think it was interesting in Marquette because politically, Marquette is a very Democratic city. This is not a case of Republicans sort of shunning the Democrats in the Southeast, but it's just a different kind of place. And of course, in defense of Detroit and the Detroit area, it's very hard for people in the Upper Peninsula, in Northwest Lower Michigan, to grasp the enormity of both the size of the population and of also the problems that are there.
And I think this disconnects, it works both ways. I would suspect if you talk to many folks here in Southeast Michigan who have never been into the Upper Peninsula, let's say, there's no sense of what it's like except, you know, upers and water, and people don't understand each other from either end of the state.
It's interesting. My sister moved to Nagani 25 years ago from East Lansing, and it was a culture shock to her. It's sort of like how Jack described. I mean, it's just a whole different world up there. And once you become a part of that culture, you really don't go below the bridge that much.
And also, I think you have to remember that, especially in the Upper Peninsula, especially in the Western Upper Peninsula, these people have always been poor, at least since the lumber and copper industries left. They've never had a whole lot of money. So it may be harder for them to be sympathetic to some of the problems of Detroit.
I think that's exactly right, Jack. They have the attitude of being self-sustaining and can't quite understand why other people aren't. Their demands for things, just aren't great.
I'm speaking with Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry and also Ken Winter, who's the former editor and publisher of the Petoskey News Review, kind of getting a look at the view from up north of Detroit's bankruptcy. Is this sense of disconnection and a different place between north and south, is it more pronounced, do you guys think, in Michigan than in other states?
From my conversations with a lot of people that end up summering here from all parts of the Midwest and West Coast and South Florida, it isn't. I mean, there's a lot of divide among states. Illinois is a good example, Ohio, Indiana, how people in the cities view the people in the rural areas. I don't know how you feel about that, Jack.
I think it depends on the state. I think that's right, Ken. I lived for a number of years in Memphis, Tennessee. Tennessee is a state that is horizontally about as long as Michigan is vertically, and they felt that they were completely removed from East Tennessee. We had a story on the front page once mentioning Tennessee's border with Virginia, and all sorts of people called and said, Tennessee doesn't have a border with Virginia. Well, it does, but they weren't aware of anything about East Tennessee. And in California, I think there's a huge disconnect between Northern and Southern California.
You know, since writing that column, the whole issue on race starts to pop up again, too. I've noticed a few comments on the column that I wrote, but I've also heard other people talk about it, too. And I was surprised. I always thought that Governor Milliken and Coleman Young were really sort of the bridge between the two areas, worked very hard across the aisle to accomplish things for the betterment of the state. But now I'm hearing that they blame Coleman Young for the race issue.
I think that Governor Milliken and Coleman Young, I mean, what they did in their time was very admirable, and people like us remember them, but I'm afraid it didn't have a lasting impact. Now, I think in northern Michigan, at least people I know, race is not a major factor. Detroit is seen as sort of an alien world, but it's more small town versus big city. I'll never forget, I have a tiny house in Charlevoix, and when I moved in, the neighbor said, I know you're not from here, and I said, why? He said, you lock your door when you go away.
Is there a sense of connection, say, with West Michigan? Do the folks in northern Michigan, say, in northwest Michigan, feel maybe a greater connection with Grand Rapids?
You know, that's interesting, because I grew up in Lansing, and when I moved north, some 40 years ago, and till this day, I notice that more people go to Grand Rapids and to western Michigan to do things than they do to go to Detroit. And that was really a surprise to me, because when growing up in Lansing, we always went to Detroit, never went to Grand Rapids.
Yeah. But is that all bad? I mean, is it perhaps not a good thing for us as states of the Union to have our sense of regionalism and our sense of local identity?
I don't see how you can avoid it if you want to be successful. Jack's more the political analyst, but economically, it just makes sense. Particularly in the rural areas, we have to share a lot of services because each of the smaller communities can't afford particular things. But on a regional basis, they can have those services, such as planning, economic development, that type of thing.
That's true. I think you also need to remember that in places like Petoskey, which Ken knows far better than I, but Charlevoix, when you talk about the big city, for a significant number of people, that's Chicago, or it's St. Louis. There's a lot of people who look west who really don't look to Michigan at all. There are more people here who look to Grand Rapids, but I think in the Upper Peninsula, Grand Rapids and Detroit and all of us are lumped together as down there.
Don't they more often, Jack, go to Green Bay
I was just going to say that. The people in Marquette that I talked to were sort of oriented to sort of Green Bay, maybe even Milwaukee. Wisconsin was their sort of urban destination of choice.
A lot of Packer signs I see.
I guess overall, is it any reason to be concerned at the sense that the Detroit bankruptcy and Detroit's troubles really doesn't matter in the lives of people in Fife Lake or Escanaba?
I didn't think so until I went to a business leaders forum here underwritten by our hospital last week, and hadn't really occurred to me the effect or impact bond ratings could have if, you know, Detroit sinks and some of the other major cities on the brink of financial collapse. It's going to make it harder for us to get money all over.
Well, that's certainly true. But on the other hand, Cindy, you need to keep in perspective the fact that the entire Upper Peninsula has about 310,000 people. That's just over one-third the population of Macomb County. They have a lot of wonderful scenery, but there's not a whole heck of a lot of people up here. And even in North, if you look at the 1st Congressional District, Michigan, of course, has 14, the 1st Congressional District is all of the Upper Peninsula and a huge chunk of the Northern Lower Peninsula because the population's so sparse up here.
That's some real perspective for us. So bottom line, what do you think that this disconnect or this ho-hum attitude means for Michigan as a state, Ken?
I don't think it's going to mean a great deal other than I think people here want to continue with their lives as they are and able to take advantage of some of the amenities that the urban areas offer, but don't really feel that they have a lot invested in it.
And Jack, last word for you.
I think we'd be concerned if you saw people with pitchforks and torchlight parades saying, we don't want to send one more of our penny of our tax dollars to those people down there. Yeah. But I don't see any open hostility. There's just they're just sort of passivity, I think. And, you know, that's too bad, but we got to get on with our lives.
And as you pointed out in your commentary, Jack, as you talked to people in Marquette, they were more befuddled and exasperated by all the news attention given to Anthony Weiner in New York than they were bothered by what's happening in Detroit.
But in a sense, these people I talked to, there's a very famous restaurant called Donkers there where President Obama went. And the folks there regarded what they were watching on the news about Egypt and about Detroit as pretty much the same sort of thing. You know, troubles in peoples who are far away of whom we know nothing, as Neville Chamberlain said.
Yeah, right.
Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry. You can find his commentary, The UP's View of Detroit, at michiganradio.org. And Ken Winter, former editor and publisher of the Petoskey News Review. And his guest column in Bridge is entitled Northern Michigan Residents Ho-Hum Over Detroit's Bankruptcy. Thanks to both of you for talking with us and making me wish that I was up north with you.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You know, it's kind of hard to believe, but in the entire history of Michigan, there has been only one state poet laureate, Edgar Guest. But the Upper Peninsula can now boast of having its own poet laureate. Recent voting in a grassroots campaign gave that honor to my next guest. From Marquette, we welcome Russell Thornburn. Hello, Russell.
Hello.
Well, there certainly seems to be a rise in poets laureate from small cities and towns and regions. The New York Times has taken a look at that. Why do you think regional poets laureate positions have become popular?
Well, we need a witness to a geographic area. It's necessary for a culture to survive, to, you know, have some attention paid to it.
It certainly is interesting that this rise in regional poets laureate comes at the same time there are growing concerns that our nation's regional differences are kind of being sanded down through mass media and the internet, maybe, but we're all becoming very much the same from coast to coast. Could you talk about that a little more?
The Upper Peninsula is quite different from the Lower Peninsula, for one. It's primarily wilderness, and it's hard up here with the snow, the distance, the traveling, but it has a very rich history behind it. And that's what I want to deal with as a poet laureate, the history behind the Upper Peninsula, as well as, you know, the idea of distance, traveling, narratives of travelers through the wilderness, also paying, you know, homage to the incredible beauty that's here as well.
Would you share one of your poems with us, Russell?
Sure. Well, it's about snow. Snowstorm. We snap pictures through holes in the battered door. Our mentor pulls his collar up, says in a dark voice, there's more bite to the snow. We mug for each camera, find peeling wallpaper inside photogenic, along with broken cups and plates dusted with the dead. Then pocket our cameras to watch the metal fence disappear, snow fall so fast over our car. We're the blind, wondering why trees undress themselves for the snow, or why some say sadness is thick and melancholy thin. Our mentor trips over the fence, and we all follow him down onto our backs and lie there, not knowing why winter collects so many fools. Our prayers from last night still rise from bent knees, water flowing through bones in a creek, and we hear a silence inside answer, the chair not sat in for 20 years that creaks, and the snowstorm dazzles with more flakes. We can't expect to enter an empty farmhouse in a cornfield, but one of us shouts he's found the car. Our ears pitch like dogs to the higher frequencies, wind rattling tree branches. Then, as if from inside us, newspapers crinkle, and we wonder about the farmer who lived here, if he suddenly hauled a bucket from inside him, leaving his bones to be collected, grown whiter on a table than an old man's hair.
Ooh, that is Russell Thorburn, who is the Upper Peninsula Poet Laureate. What do the people who say, I don't get poetry, what are they missing out on, do you think?
The music, the great, you know, cadences of someone, you know, creating some moment, you know, walking into an abandoned house or, you know, looking at the different heights of children on the, you know, the door and things. All these little mysteries and things can be very wonderful.
Will you give us one more poem, please?
Sure. Just a short one. Sting. His hands almost buzzing through her hair. She loved when he touched her, a husband who undid the pins for her hive of honey. His fingers involved in their study of hair, bangs over her brow, strands in their flight over her ears. She sat there quietly, hearing that buzz grow stronger when he bent over and buzzed her lips with a kiss.
That was wonderful. Russell Thorburn is the Upper Peninsula Poet Laureate, and he spoke to us from Marquette. Russell, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's easy to connect with us here at Stateside. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. On Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and that's C-A-N-T-Y. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, and Katie Suha. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for joining us today, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.